Hallo und herzlich willkommen zum Nummer 96. Datengarten hier im Wohnzimmer des Chaos Computer Clubs Berlin. Schön, dass ihr alle so zahlreich gekommen seid, direkt nach dem Kongress im ersten Jahr, der erste Datengarten im neuen Jahr. Und da freut es mich auf jeden Fall sehr, dass wir da einen wundervollen Speaker heute begrüßen dürfen. Ich wünsche mir einen großen Applaus für Veit. Veit Heller. Veit erzählt uns heute etwas über das, was wir sehr häufig verwenden und was für viele von uns tatsächlich mehr so eine Art Blackbox ist. Es geht heute um Compiler. Wie kommen wir von Programmcode zum Problem bzw. zum Maschinencode? Okay, und kurz vorweg noch ein bisschen Organisatorisches. Ihr seht, wir streamen heute und wir zeichnen noch wieder auf. Und das heißt, wenn ihr natürlich Fragen habt und ihr dürft auch gerne Fragen stellen, dann komme ich hier mit diesem Mikrofon zu euch, damit wir auch die Frage dann auf dem Stream respektive auf der Aufnahme daneben haben. Ja, und ansonsten würde ich sagen, viel Spaß bei Programming Languages and Trust von Veit Heller.
Hello everyone. I hope you can hear me all right. Before we start, two little disclaimers. So first of all, I'm going to take questions at checkpoints because there are many different topics that we'll cover, and so we can group them by topics. And it also, you don't have to remember all of your questions to the very end. So this is the first disclaimer, and the second disclaimer, I promptly forgot. No, this is a two-part talk where, first of all, I'm going to introduce programming languages, so compilers and interpreters, and how they work, or a little bit about them. I mean, there is multiple lifetimes of research going into them, so I can't possibly fit all of them into what is about 1 hour of talking time. But I will try to give you a good picture to start off, and then we're going to go into the second section, which is shorter, and we're going to talk about trust levels. So if you're into security, the second part might be interesting, and if you're into compilers, the first. So let's just start. Obligatory slide of who I am. I work at a consultancy. I am not a professional. I hack on languages in my free time. Some of the more notable ones. So Septo is a programming language that I worked on for a few years and wrote my bachelor thesis about. Carp is one that I actively develop with a few people that is actually quite fun. And CSPFuck I'm going to give a little demo about or on. And that's all you need to know about me for this talk. So the first section is about compilers and interpreters. So this slide is a lie already. I haven't told you anything about compilers and already lied to you. The first thing that we think about when you think about compilers is, or about programming language implementations, is that there are compilers and there are interpreters. And compilers transform source code into some form of executable code. Usually that's, I mean, that's more often than not machine code. And interpreters take in source code and evaluate it directly. Of course, reality isn't that easy. Most real implementations of programming languages transform their source in some way or another. That is because often the source code doesn't really match the semantics of a system very well. They're good for people. They're not so great for the machine. So you will have one or multiple internal representations that have multiple names, depending on what programming language you look at. Some names that you might encounter are abstract syntax tree or parse tree or intermediate representation, which you might encounter when you work with LLVM or bytecode or bitcode, which is another LLVM thing. Bytecode and bitcode usually are things that you use in an interpreter to interpret things, but they can also they can also be an internal representation of some sort. And then you also have transpilers, which make everything even more messy because they don't compile into native code, but into another high-level language. And you know, they're just compilers like anything else. The name transpilers is a bit... I do not want to say that everyone hates it, but most people who work on languages don't like it because just because you compile to a different target doesn't mean it's not a compiler. It's a compiler like anything else. Transpilers just take a language like in C, if you look at MScripten, and output, in the case of MScripten, JavaScript or SMJS, which is a very optimizable subset of JavaScript. And they're just compilers in their own right, right? So there is a lot of very interesting stuff going on there, and it's not easy to draw a line between different implementations. So what we're left with is that there is some sort of pipeline that takes in source code, transforms it, and spits out another representation, or evaluates it and spits out the output. But that's not super helpful, because that describes pretty much most of our programs, except they don't take in source code. But all programs are sort of pipelines that transform data somehow. So if you look at a compiler textbook and you start out, you might see something like this. You might see this pipeline. It takes in source code. There's a front end. It spits out intermediate representation. There's a back end. And then there's some output. But that doesn't tell us anything either, right? Because the front end is complex in its own right. It might do any of the steps of parsing, lexing. It might do some lexical analysis. It might do some semantic analysis. It might do transformations on the abstract syntax tree already, or the intermediate representation. The backend might also do some semantic analysis, and then some optimizations, and either evaluate or just output machine code. So there's any number of things that you can cram into those two little unassuming boxes. So what you really need to think about is that a programming language, an implementation of a programming language, can be as simple as this. This is almost a full brainfuck virtual machine that is basically the complete evaluator. Some of the plumbing code has been omitted. It's not very safe because this is C and I don't check bounds of anything, but it works for valid brainfuck programs. You can crash it really easily by writing a non-valid brainfuck program, but other than that, it will work. But if you look at it, it doesn't even do parsing. It just, because brainfuck is an executable bytecode, because each character is one instruction, I can just use that as my intermediate representation without taking the intermediate step. But most programming languages aren't like that. In most programming languages, you will have a pipeline like this. This is the Haskell pipeline, and I picked it because A, it has, I don't expect you to read this, because A, it has a very small picture of all of the steps, and B, it is weird. It outputs three different things, then there is this second output that happens halfway through, and then there's the step that feeds back into itself. And so this is not an easy pipeline to grasp front to back, but this is what you might need depending on how complex your language is and how far removed it is from the actual platform. So if you've never encountered Haskell, you might ask yourself why it needs something like that. And for simple languages, huge pipelines might seem overkill. It might seem like you're over-engineering the heck out of your compiler. But if you have cleanly separated steps, and Haskell does have them, then they bias modularity and clarity. And you can write an extra optimization step without touching anything else in the compiler. And this is really what you want. In the early days, if you look at GCC, for instance, all of the passes were kind of intertwined and everything did something at the same time. And it was really messy to do anything. It's better these days, but if you compare it to younger projects like LLVM or Clang, they have better modularity, and it's easier to add in extra steps. And for me, as someone who writes passes, it's great because I can test the passes individually. I can think about, okay, so this pass that I wrote does this one thing, so I'm going to give it these inputs and see whether the transformations work. I don't have to go through the whole compiler and see whether my output, my pass changes the output. On the extreme end of the spectrum, you have nanopass compilers. I have a huge reference table at the end. So if you want to check any of the things that I just gloss over and just name drop, there's a lot of references in the end, and you can just ask me. But I want to talk briefly about nanopass compilers because I enjoy them, though I do not work with them usually. There is this guy called Andy Keep who wrote a nice framework for nanopass compilers where you can write compilers with lots of little steps, little passes that just do one thing. Some of the passes might be big, like the parsing step is usually pretty involved because it has to go through the whole source tree and, or rather, generate a whole source tree from an input string. But then if you go through some of the passes, some of them are extremely simple. Like there is one in a C compiler that he wrote that is just called remove one-armed if, and all that it does is, for the convenience of the later passes, if there's a if that doesn't have an else, it just adds an empty else branch so that you don't have to pattern match on like on one-armed ifs anymore. You always know that there is an else branch here. So that removes one extra branch. And that's just nice, because usually you don't want to special case too much. Anyway, they allow for things like this, and if you want to play around with them, there is a link in my references. And I think I'm mostly done with the like abstract, what does a pipeline look like? We're going to go into what that actually means, because that has all been terribly abstract and probably didn't tell you much. But all of your intuitions will hopefully fall into place in the next section when I show you a bunch of these passes. But before I do that, do you have anything that you want to know about anything that I just said? No questions.
No questions from the audience at this point.
Perfect. Okay, we can go through some of the passes and look at what you might find if you pop open a compiler or an interpreter. So the first thing that you mostly do is tokenizing, lexing, or parsing. Most language implementations have a parser. I say most because, well, this one doesn't. But so most language implementations have a parser, and if you look at how it is implemented, you often have a tokenizer or a lexer before that is either auto-generated or handwritten, and all it does is split up your huge program into a list of tokens. These tokens are also just strings, but they're the things that have individual semantic value lexemes. So something like an equals, or maybe a name, or a keyword, right? Sometimes that's as simple as splitting up the source string on whitespace, but sometimes it isn't. And then you have the parser as the next step, which generates intermediate representation or an AST from the source code or the tokens, depending on whether you have a lexer or not. Okay, but if you look at these two, parsers are generally more interesting. You can auto-generate your parsers as well, like you did with Tokenizer Elixir, if you choose to auto-generate all of that, you should either use Antler if you use something like Java or C# or any object-oriented language, because it auto-generates all kinds of classes for you, or if you want some more, if you want more language semantics independent, you can have Lex or Flex and Yak or Bison. Bison and Flex are the generators that will that are open source, and they will take in a grammar and spit out some code that parses that grammar. That is nice because you always have an up-to-date grammar of your language. It's not so nice because you have no control over the code that is being generated, or little. It's also quite boring. I find it quite boring, especially if you want to learn something about how languages work. If you want to start out and learn how languages work or how a parser works, then I suggest you either write it manually or you use a more low-level framework. If you write it manually, you can. A popular algorithm is recursive descent. If you do not, some of my personal favorites, all of these slides with all of the passes are loaded with personal opinions. So if you want to know anything about something that I don't mention, ask me. I can't in the Q&A. I can't promise that I know anything about them, but I will try to give an answer. So my personal favorites in the parsing realm are recursive descent, GLL, which stands for generalized left-to-right leftmost derivation, Ometa and Parsec. Recursive descent is fairly simple. If you want to write it yourself, it basically means you have a parse rule that you go into, and either it matches or it will call the next rule that has lower precedence or might make sense. And then it does that until it finds something that matches or it errors out. It's simple enough. The problem with it cannot handle something that is called left recursive grammars. Left recursive grammars, that just means that you have recursion as the very first thing that you do in a parse rule. So, for instance, if you have an expression, and an expression might be addition, and addition might be composed of expression plus expression, then the first thing that you do when you parse an expression is parse an expression. And if you've ever done recursion, you do not want the first thing you do to be recursion, right? Because then you will loop or recurse infinitely. What you want is you put your base cases first. It's the same with grammars, except that we can solve it. We can solve parsing left recursive grammars if we use something else. If we use GLL, for instance, which is the next thing on my list. So if you ever find yourself having to write a left recursive grammar, you use something like GLL, which stands for generalized left to right leftmost derivation, which is a mouthful, but it's also it's actually super simple. You use as bases, you use your regular parsing that you would do with LL1 or LLK, which is left to right leftmost derivation, but not generalized. So you would just parse from left to right with the leftmost rule, so the first rule being the first rule. But it's generalized in such a way that all of the things that you, all of the parses that you do are actually done independently and at the same time, and you use backtracking to go to get back up the chain. And also it uses memoization to make it more efficient, usually. Okay, so that's GLL. Then there's Ometa, which was done by Alessandro Worth to make experimenting with languages easier. So if you find yourself with the idea of I want to write JavaScript, but it should have this additional keyword, or I want to write C, but I really need an async keyword, or whatever. you can use the existing parser and extend it. So what Almeda is a parsing and evaluation framework that also, through object orientation, makes it extensible. So you can add additional parse rules without touching any of the rest of the parsers. It's quite nice. There are implementations of in a bunch of languages. I think the reference implementation is in JavaScript, but there's also Scheme for the Lispers. There is F-sharp that a friend of mine maintains. There's OCaml. There is all kinds of languages. But mostly, I mean, as with many of these algorithms, you will find them in implemented in languages that compiler engineers use. And that is often either a functional language or C or C++. It's seldom something like Python. It exists in Python, but not that many people write their language implementations in Python, for instance. The last one is Parsec or Parser. I want to talk about parser combinators in general. Parser combinators are just, use the idea of combining parsers to generate bigger parsers. So you might have, as a base case, have a digit parser that just parses a number from 0 to 9. Then you have a combinator called many that parses many of any parser. You stick the two together, you get many digits, so a number. But you build your parsers out of these basic building blocks, and you really see how the individual pieces are strung together. So that's really nice. But again, so parser combinators also, they mostly exist, in languages that are used by compiler engineers or language people. So Haskell has a few good implementations of parser combinators, but many other languages do not. So that's kind of a bummer. If you want to write one, I would be eternally grateful, say in JavaScript or in Python or in C would be fun, probably. So all that being said, my rule of thumb is don't over-engineer it early on. Your parser is usually one of the simpler parts of your language, and it's seldom the bottleneck. It's especially if it's an interpreter. You might want to spend your time optimizing the interpreter and not the parser. It's also easy to replace, so if you find yourself wanting to implement a different parser altogether, you mostly can just do that. I'm going through a few more steps. I'm going through type checking and optimization, and I think that those are the steps that I really want to cover. Do you have any questions at this point? Am I going too fast? Am I glossing over too many things? Are you missing context? Anything?
Looks like the audience is still good.
I hope so. Okay, next step, type checking. Again, this is very opinionated. You can have a lot of fun with types. I write mostly in either dynamically typed programming languages or languages with not very expressive type systems at my day job. But I have a soft spot for ML-like type systems, so OCaml, Haskell, that kind of stuff, because they have this very simple type checking algorithm that's called Hindley-Milner that also comes with a type inference algorithm. So you don't even have to annotate your program with types anymore. It will just figure things out. And that is usually extremely helpful, and that's really what you want. You don't want to write your types as a programmer if the compiler can infer them for you. So I have a soft spot for that. That being said, you really need some in product types to make this interesting. Anyone know what sum and product types are, or who needs an explainer what sum and product types are? A lot of people, probably, yeah. Because that is basically a Haskell or OCaml thing. So product types are structs, basically. So they're types constructed out of other types. So you might have an address type that's composed out of a house number and a street name, or whatever. That's a product type. A sum type is a bit harder to explain because it doesn't exist in that many different languages, but in Haskell or Camel, it's a data type with multiple type constructors. So the closest you get to that in a mainstream, maybe an object-oriented language, would be something like an interface with multiple implementing classes that implement this interface. So you can have a generic over these things, and it will just work, and then see which class is this. They're useful for generic things, and they're useful for a bunch of traversal and other. I just use them all the time when I'm in Haskell, and I forget that they're not there in other languages because they're not necessary. They're in other languages because they solve the problem differently. I like them, though, so I want to mention them. You can go wild, though. You can implement dependent types, liquid types, a whole bunch of things that I don't understand. I know what dependent types are. They're basically types that have constraints on the type level and functions that can operate on them. So you can say something like, this is a list and it has to contain integers, but the integers all have to be greater than 10. You can express things like that on a type level. Then liquid types are dependent types on steroids. It's even more powerful. But at this point, I largely zone out because I have no idea why this is important. But apparently they are. There are so many type systems that I forget mostly what they're for. But if you want to, you can spend multiple lifetimes studying them and have a great time, I hear. And lastly, again, you don't need a pass for that, especially if you're building a dynamic language. But even if you have a dynamic language, it might be interesting because specialized code is usually faster than generic code. So if you know that a function can only be called with integers, you can specialize it on integers, and it will be faster than a version that works on all types. So if you want to add type checking to a language, that's a bit more involved usually. Because if you look at, for instance, Python, and you want to add types to that, which they recently did with type hints. But if you want to add types to that, you basically have to rewrite everything that comes after that type checking stage. Whereas with parsers, you can just say, OK, the parse tree looks the same afterwards, so it's fine. But with types, you always carry around extra information, and so the data type doesn't look the same anymore. So no matter what you do, you will have to change everything. And that's kind of a pain. So if you think about writing your own language, think about whether you want to check types early on. Optimizations, that's the fun one. That's probably the one where everyone thinks, here be dragons. But it's very anticlimactic, but they're heavily language dependent. There are some that you can do in many languages, but if we go back to Haskell, I talk about Haskell a lot. I'm not actually a Haskell programmer, but it is an interesting language from a compiler perspective. It is lazy, it is functional, it has these purity constraints, and everything's curried. That means you can either call the function with all of the arguments or some of the arguments and get back a function that takes the rest of the arguments. So all of this provides a challenge for someone implementing the language, because all of these you have to somehow express, and not only at compile time, but something like laziness has to be done at runtime too. So there's a bunch of interesting stuff in Haskell because of that. A lot of reordering going on, but also because it's pure, you have something like common sub-expression elimination that is more popular than other languages. So that's an optimization that you find all over the place in compilers, where you see that the result of something is reused, so you just compute it once instead of recomputing it. You say something like i plus 1, as the and store the result in multiple places, you can just do it once and then save it in a temporary variable and put that temporary variable into the places where the sub-expression was. But that only works if you know that the code is pure. If the code performs side effects, so it's the print function or something like that, it's not the same thing if you move the print out of the loop than if you print inside the loop every time the loop is called. So these guarantees about purity are very important for compiler optimizations as well. And most compilers will actually check for purity. They will check for pure functions, but they have to do so implicitly, and we never know about it. Another thing, it's not always... So you might think that I have this high-level expression. I want to optimize it to a lot of small, low-level steps. That's not always the case. We're going to look at that in a moment. It's not black magic. It often feels like it is, but that's just because the person who added that optimization pass really wanted to publish a paper that year, and so they spent a lot of time thinking about an optimization pass. And it might be interesting to you, or it might not be. But as a result, there is a lot of like specialized knowledge, and that often feels like black magic, especially if it's all in one project. So if you look at something like GCC today, you will not be able to understand the whole code base or all optimization passes, just because some of them are on obscure systems. Some of them do weird stuff that someone in the 90s measured was faster than this other thing, and so on. So you might not be able to replicate the results even. The good news is, if you use a compiler framework, and most people use LLVM, I don't use LLVM all that often because I like to hand-generate my my code, but if you use LLVM, you already have a bunch of optimization passes. All of the optimization passes pretty much that go into Clang, for instance, except the C-specific ones, will be available to you. Cool. With that out of the way, I gave you a bunch of examples of what happens inside a compiler pipeline, and I would like to demo something. Before we do that, though, who of you knows BrainFuck or can read BrainFuck? Ooh, not that many. Okay, we're going to look at CSPFuck, which is a multi-threaded BrainFuck implementation that I wrote. Yes, I know. I'm not going to talk about the multi-threaded part, though, because it's interesting but not relevant. What's relevant is that I spent some time optimizing the thing. And so it's backwards compatible with BrainFuck, and we're just going to look at it as a fast BrainFuck interpreter, or a JIT compiler even. What a JIT compiler is, we will talk about in a second. But first, I will motivate a little bit what an optimization might look like, a language-specific one. So, if you can read BrainFuck, do you know what this means, this little bracket thing? You might or you might not. I have to explain BrainFuck anyway, so I will explain the whole thing. So BrainFuck is a Turing machine. And the idea is that you have a tape with infinitely many cells. We usually use 30,000 cells because we don't have infinite memory. And each cell contains one value. You can perform 8 operations. You can either go forward one cell, go backward one cell, increment the current cell, decrement the current cell, print the current cell, read in a value, usually from standard in, into the current cell, and loop. And this thing, loops, loops usually are, so what you could write them as is while the current cell isn't zero. So what this does is it loops and it decrements. That means it loops until the current value is zero, and it does so by decrementing, checking again, decrementing, checking again. But all it does is set the current value under the tape to zero. We can remove the whole loop. We can just say, x equals 0, and we're done. So this would be an optimization. And it's an optimization by looking at the language and realizing that there's another higher level construct. You don't have to emit specialized code for that. All you have to do is see, hey, there is this expression, and it's actually an idiom. It's one thing. Okay, so with that out of the way, we're going to look at CSPFUG. And the first thing that we're going to do, it's only a few hundred lines of code, so it compiles pretty quickly. We're also going to time it, just because we want to see whether it's faster. And we're going to render Mandelbrot in ASCII. So the BrainFuck program that is run here is not written by me, because I couldn't write a BrainFuck program like that. It's auto-generated by someone. But it's pretty cool. So this is a Turing machine printing out the Mandelbrot set. That's pretty nice. But it does so very slowly, because this is an unoptimized interpreter, and gosh, it's slow. That's not nice. If we look at the parser, it's pretty straightforward. Just builds a bunch of operations. We might not want to look at this code at all anyway. But it's nice to. Oh yeah, here's some debug include. We might not even care about most of this, but it already optimizes that thing that I showed you earlier, where it just sees, hey, there is this loop, and all it does is increment, or all it does is decrement, so we can just zero it. The evaluator, on the other hand, is this little virtual machine, and this is the BrainFuck part, and it's really, really short. It's almost identical to the BrainFuck virtual machine that I showed you earlier. So it does something. It is super simple, but it's super inefficient, and it's also not safe. None of the code here is really all that safe, because I don't have time for that. No, this was just an experiment, so it's fine. But I looked at this interpreter, and I wasn't happy with the performance, and so I wrote this interpreter, and it's a little bit faster. It runs in 3.7 seconds, and it doesn't do all that much differently. It's actually, if you look at the parser, it does most of the things similarly. What it does is it optimizes a bunch of other loop cases, and it also groups statements together. Because in BrainFuck, you can only increment a thing 10 times instead of adding 10 to it. What I can do is I can look at a series of increments and just say, oh, this thing increments by 10, so I will just do that instead of doing it 10 times by 1, right? So this is pretty much all that happened. And on the side of the interpreter, instead of a switch and a while loop, we use something called computed go-tos. So this is ugly code that just has a bunch of go-tos that jump between each other until they're done. That is actually how most bytecode virtual machines look on the inside, because it's much faster somehow than an unconditional loop with a switch statement inside. You wouldn't think of that, because you would think that it just compiles down to go-tos, but somehow it doesn't. So a lot of, if you look at the bytecode virtual machine for Python, it will look basically the same, except that there are more elaborate macros and it's 3,000 lines long. Other than that, it's basically the same. But at this point, I hit a roadblock, because it was at 3.7 seconds. I really wanted a zero in front of that. I wanted 0.7 seconds. But I couldn't see any more optimization things, because at the language level, I looked at all of the things that people know about BrainFuck as idioms, and I special cased them. On the virtual machine level, everything that I know about how I can optimize this, I tried, and it's okay. It's a 10x speedup, but I added a JIT compiler, and so I hand rolled this JIT. It doesn't use any framework because that would be silly. The whole thing is only 300 lines long. I don't want to have LLVM as a dependency and suddenly have 4 million lines of code and then my 300-line program. So instead, I hand rolled some assembly, or rather machine code, and now it runs in about 1 second. Sadly, there is no zero in front of that. There's still a one. So I have to figure out how to get rid of that. But if we look at... So the parser hasn't changed again. The evaluator has. And what has changed is basically everything, because we moved away from a virtual machine entirely. What I do is I emit machine code, and then I jump into that machine code, and it will run. And what that looks like if you don't use a framework and you don't want to write abstractions is like this. It's just a bunch of hexadecimal numbers. All of these hexadecimal numbers correspond to a bunch of instructions. So the simplest instruction that I can show you is at the very end, this one thing, add 0x C3, add is a macro again, but add 0x C3 means add a ret statement at the very end. So this is what this does, and it works. It took me a bunch of hours in LLDB, but it is actually fairly straightforward if you look through it. Of course, there are no comments explaining what assembly instructions I emit because, you know, you look up the Intel manual. I did the hard work already. but then once we have generated that, it is really simple to just jump to random memory and see. All you do is you call mmap instead of alloc or malloc. You put in a bunch of flags that you don't care about. You copy in your buffer that you generated. You say, oh, by the way, this bit of random memory is executable. You cast it to a function type, and then you call the function as if it were a random function. This is nuts for me, because that was a random byte array just a second ago, right? But this is actually how JIT compilers work. You just jump to a random place in memory that happens to contain valid code. It will work. And the most nuts is actually happening in the not brainfuck part, the receive and the send. Because what I do here is I actually put in addresses of C functions that I define in my original compiler to call. And these are the functions. They're just regular C functions. And you can just put in the address of those, and it will happily jump to your C code again and then back into your generated code. It's beautiful, and it's ugly, and it runs really fast. But this is what you might do if you want to optimize your code. If you want to just have a reference implementation, something like this might suffice. If you want to have something run really, really fast, then you might go to through the lengths that I went through when I implemented the CSP fuck. So, with all this out of the way, I am done with the compilers part. I don't know whether you know any more about compilers and interpreters than you did before, but I'm happy to answer any and all questions that you might have at this point. Still no questions.
No, audience still good.
Okay. All right. Either I'm telling you... Oh.
Have you tried SMI instructions?
I have not. I have not.
Can you please repeat the question?
Yes. Have I tried SMI instructions? I am not actually sure what that means, but I have not. What are SMI instructions?
Basically, with like single data or multiple instructions.
Or oh, SIMD, yeah.
SIMD. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. SIMD, so single instruction, multiple data, I have not. I have not vectorized the code. I could do that. That would probably be faster. That's a good idea. You shouldn't give me those ideas. Yeah, so I think that's all I have to say about the first part. So let's just jump to the interesting bit about trust, because that might be more interesting to the people who don't care about compilers. So in 1984, this relatively unknown guy called Ken Thompson, you might know him from this little thing called Unix that he did. So he received the Turing Award, but he hadn't worked on Unix for over 10 years at this point, and he didn't want to talk about it, because he felt if he did, then he would have gotten something out of other people's work. And other interesting stuff afterwards. So he talked about another fun thing, which is malicious compilers. And just what he means by malicious, he explained in 3 pages. And those 3 pages are supremely readable. So if you want to read this paper, I encourage you to do so. No matter what your skill level is, you will always take something away from it. You might not understand the whole thing, but his writing style is just stellar. Okay, so the whole thing has 3 stages, as he calls them, and so I'm going to go through the 3 stages. First, he explains quines. They are programs that, when evaluated, print out their own source code without looking at the text file. That's a fun exercise to do. If you haven't done that, I encourage you to think about how to do that in your favorite programming language. It is not always trivial. Some languages make it easier than others, but it is a worthy effort, and it makes a lot of it makes a lot of sense to try that. Maybe not sense, but it is fun. The second stage he goes into is bootstrapping compilers. So those are compilers that can compile themselves. That requires the compiler to be written in that language. So a C compiler written in C could compile itself. To be able to do that, first you need a reference implementation in another language. For instance, a C compiler or interpreter written in assembly that can look at the first thing and evaluate that, and then you have the second piece. And from then on, you don't need anything else. You can work with your language entirely in your language if you have that binary artifact. And then he thought about, in the 3rd stage, compiling a bugged, not buggy, but bugged, deliberately riddled with bugs version of your compiler. And then shipping it, because many of us use binary repositories to download their packages, so why not, right? And then I'm going to give the stage to him, basically, and I'm going to just read a few quotes. The actual bug I planted in the compiler would match code in the Unix login command. The replacement code would miscompile the login command so that it would accept either the intended encrypted password or a particular known password. Thus, if this code were installed in binary and the binary were used to compile the login command, I could log into that system as any user. Simple enough. Now, he observed that this isn't perfect because there are people looking at your compiler code, not all the time and not in all places, but at some point, someone will notice that you planted a bug in the compiler, hopefully. And he says such blatant code would not go undetected for long. Even the most casual perusal of the source of the C compiler would raise suspicions. Just how you casually peruse the C compiler, I don't know. I need to sit down and actually think about it to understand it, but maybe he can just, you know, skim it on a lazy afternoon. And so he goes to another stage. The second approach simply adds a second Trojan horse to the one that already exists. The second pattern is aimed at the C compiler. First, we compile the modified source with a normal C compiler to produce a bug binary. We install this binary as the official C. We can now remove the bugs from the source of the compiler, and the new binary will reinsert the bugs whenever it is compiled. Of course, the login command will remain bugged with no trace in source anywhere. So this is nice. You think you compile a benign compiler. You try to get rid of the bug, maybe, but you can't because it will reinsert the bug. He also observes that if the C compiler isn't your target because you only run packages that were written in Python or that were written in anything else, well, you could also do things like maybe rig the assembler instead, or rig the linker, or rig any stage of anything, and that is part of your compilation toolchain, and it will work just the same. In fact, he even mentioned that if you rig the disassembler too, you might not even see it under the disassembler, right? So this is extremely malicious. This is the most fun hack I've ever seen, but it's also mostly a practical joke. It's very scary, but it's unlikely that someone does this, right? Maybe the scary advanced persistent threats we keep hearing about have the manpower to do so, but, you know, it's not that likely. But as our compilers get more complex and more modular, especially the more modular part is both good and bad, because if you think about Clang or GHC, or any industrial-grade compiler that is also used for research, they will have a plugin system that you can introduce new optimization phases in. If you just happen to have one malicious plugin, that could work as well. It wouldn't be as cute as the hack that Ken Thompson thought of, but it would be just as malicious. And then also I invite you to think about all the obscure code you have ever seen, and you ask someone who wrote it what this means, and they just gave you an answer, and without trying to understand the code, you just accepted that this is what this was. And now you think back at CSPFUG, and you look at all of the assembly or the machine code that I emitted. And I just told you that this was the right machine code. But what if it weren't? Right? Who of you would have known that? You would have just believed me. This is actually a problem, I think. Now, I want to leave with a good note. There is kind of a workaround for this problem. For 25 years, we thought this was unsolvable, basically. You have to trust someone, and maybe that's your compiler. But then David A. Wheeler came along, and he did his PhD in 2009, and he wrote this very elaborate PhD thesis that boils down to a very simple idea. You have two compilers instead. They compile one of the two, and then you have the compiler you want to check, compiled by two different compilers. And then you compile that compiler again with the two new executables, and then you check whether they're different. If they're not different, then either both of the compilers you tested are hacked, or none of them is. If you can't quite imagine that right now, I couldn't either. I took a while to like grasp that completely, but it does work, except that most modern C compilers are non-deterministic. If you look at some of the passes in GCC, for instance, they will say, oh, this pass introduces non-determinism. If you compile your executable or your source code twice with the same settings, it might not result in the same executable. Guess branch probability is one of those, for instance. What it does is it just guesses how likely either of the branches are in your program, and it assigns it a weight for branch prediction, the thing that haunts our exploits. But it, it it actually is non-deterministic. So you might not, you might see a difference, and it might be benign. So that's kind of annoying. But if you turn off all non-determinism, then it should work. And at this point, I wanted to have another demo, but I'm not going to, simply because I would demo someone else's work, and that's kind of crappy. I encourage you to play around with that instead. He has very good, it has very good documentation. And it's this little implementation of a language that Michael Arsenius wrote, who is another one of the people I admire. And he basically wrote a little bytecode virtual machine that exhibits this behavior. The bytecode is generated by code written in the language that is compiled, so it's the same bootstrapping, but for interpreters. And there is one version of that thing that exhibits the rotten behavior, and it is called rotten. So if you want to play around with this, if this intrigues you, I suggest you go to GitHub and play with his creation. Okay, I think that's all I have. There's a bunch of references. If you just go to this repository, you will have these references, because I don't think this makes sense. But they're all there. So instead I say thank you, and do you have any questions now?
So, one question from the front of the audience.
Yes, so can you actually compile a GCC with a Clang, or the other way around?
You kind of can. I think you can. The problem with this, another problem that you have, is that both of them have added extensions over the course of their lifetime. And they don't usually use them, but some of the compiler extensions, the compiler plugins they use do. To my knowledge, maybe that it changes all the time. But some of the compiler plugins use other extensions that might just be supported by, for instance, GCC, if it's GCC, and so on. Especially GCC has a bunch of cool extensions that are very non-portable. Yeah, so.
Another question, so you pointed out, what if the JIT compiler or assembly, not assembly, but machine code emitter, mm-hmm. doesn't produce the behavior that is desired? Mm-hmm. What then? Okay, so let's take that one step further. What if the machine doesn't actually perform instructions or machine code the way you expect?
Right.
Or there are side effects?
Mm-hmm. Actually, Ken Thompson mentions that in the paper and says, what if we take this one step further from the assembler, from the linker, from the compiler, and we say, there's some microcode that might also be bugged? Yes. All of this, you have to trust something, basically, unless you solder everything by hand and you wire your own circuits and everything. If you don't do that, then you have to trust someone. The question is, are you aware that you're trusting someone at this moment? Did you think about the compiler being a target of a hack, right? If you have a threat model for that, and the threat model says, meh, I ignore this, then that's great. That's informed, like, that's an informed decision. But if you're just not aware of it, not so great.
So, any more questions? Yes, in the back. Wait a second, I'm almost there.
Hi. I was wondering, when you mentioned JIT compilation, if you have to take some countermeasures against malicious code injections. Because what you're doing basically is jumping into a bunch of memory that you have partly control over, and it just executes it.
Right. So. So it's more or less maybe the same threat model as like having anything in memory that might be written to by something else. What I didn't talk about was the multi-threaded part of the CSP fuck thing. What this means in this case is that you have as many JIT compilers running as there are threads that are then launched in the end, and they all run in the same process and have access to the same memory. So that's definitely a problem. So even there, that's already a problem, and it might be even more of a problem if you think about someone actually having access to the hardware, say, and reading out your. But I think so. For me, this threat model is basically the same. Whether someone inserts things into my compiler, or whether someone inserts things into parts of memory that one process owns, there is something very wrong with my machine at this point, right? I haven't heard of any efficient countermeasures, is what I want to say. So, yeah.
When you showed the JIT implementation, you showed that you just did MM protect on a bunch of memory.
Yes.
Is that the reason why you can't really efficiently or actually use this with modern protection systems like NX and stuff like that?
I can't actually answer that. I don't know why that is. It could be that. It could also be something else that your operating system locks down.
Wait a second, I'm coming over. Just curb yourself.
Yeah, it's quite likely that the memory you allocate on the heap is in a data segment and not executable. So unless you say otherwise.
Right. But that's why you do that syscall to say...
Exactly.
Right. Yes,
exactly.
Exactly. Okay, good.
So, any more questions?
Yeah.
I'm coming right over. It's quite crowded today, so bear with me.
Hey, thanks for the talk. One question about how you multi-threaded the brainfuck compiler.
Mm-hmm.
Just gloss over because... Mm-hmm. And if you took as an example how other compilers do that, like GCC or Dorf, or now, it's a completely different...
Okay, I think I'm going to just talk about it real quick. So the idea that started all of this was as silly as the implementation. It was that, okay, so how would two-dimensional brainfuck look like then? So like where you can not just go from here to there's... from here to here as well. And then I thought, well, I could make a matrix, but that would be kind of boring instead of a tape, because that doesn't add anything. But what adds something would be message passing. And so the semantics of CSPFuck is that each actor is one paragraph separated by a new line of brainfuck code, and they can talk to the actor below or above by sending the current cell to the other process, and then receive that asynchronously. So this is kind of like what you do in Go with channels or in Erlang with mailboxes. It's actor-based concurrency. That's why it's CSPFuck, because it's based on this idea of communicating sequential processes. And so the virtual machine was multi-threaded in the sense that for each actor, I would spawn a process, or not a process, spawn a thread, a P thread, that would take the current actor, evaluate it, and communicate with the actors that it had communication channels to. And when I wrote the JIT, the natural extension would be to fork out that as well. And so the first thing that every one of these actors does is just JIT compile. So that's basically what that means. So it's not at all like a parallel compilation of the same thing, but each actor compiles their source code.
Any more questions? Yes, from the front. Hey there.
Have you considered reproducible builds? Projects like Debian and Tor,
yes,
using them, and they include basically the entire application that they are, which include GCC and so on.
Right. So reproducible builds are a way around that to a certain extent. And they are also mentioned. And all that David A. Wheeler wanted to do was, how do I actually figure out whether my reproducible build is malicious or not malicious? So you could hack that entire reproducible build and have the Platonic ideal build be malicious, and then you're screwed as well. So that's the way how you figure that out.
Anything else? Looks a bit like we're done here.
Cool, that was fun.
Okay, dann vielen lieben Dank, Veit. Einen großen Applaus, bitte. Vielen Dank für diese Einsicht in Compiler und Bytes. Gut. Und euch wünsche ich auf jeden Fall noch einen schönen Abend. Vielen Dank für eure Aufmerksamkeit und wir sehen uns hier wieder beim nächsten Datengarten. Tschüss.